Welcome to the third episode of Is TDD Dead? I'm Kent Beck from Facebook, and I'm here with David Hanemeyer Hansen and Martin Fowler. And we're going to follow up on episode two with a conversation today about the trade-offs inherent in testing. I think of most interesting questions in software development is involving some kind of trade-off. And I do this with my hands, which I understand is reminds some people of some sort of bizarre form of modern dance, which is your problem, not mine. But what I mean to convey with that is that there's some set of costs on one side and another set of costs on another side, and there's some minima between those two curves. And depending on the way that the two cost curves are shaped, will change how exactly you decide to go on some continuum. Almost no questions in computer science can be answered A or B. The answer always begins with "it depends," and what does it depend on is the interesting part. Now, in some ideal world, we would have instant, infallible feedback about our programming decisions. So every keystroke that I make, if the code is ready to deploy, it would just instantly deploy within milliseconds. So if I just happened to create some software that works, then boom, it's instantly out to everybody. And that kind of feedback is impossible at the moment. By calling my methodology extreme programming, I learned you can't ever say never, because what seemed extreme at the time turned out not to be. But that's the ideal world, that you get this instant feedback about whether your software is ready to go or not. And the reality is that we have to back a ways off of that. And the question, I think, is how far off of that do we need to back? Some of the constraints in my mind as I'm wondering about this question is how frequently do we need feedback? And we've had a range of answers. Between the three of us, we've had a wider range of answers on the fabulous interwebs, about ranging from 100 milliseconds to minutes, certainly. So, how frequently do you need feedback about some decision that you made? Is it doing what you think it does? A second continuum is fidelity. So, in some ideal world, they'd just be red and green, and as programmers, we're comfortable with that sort of binary thinking. In fact, any set of tests is going to be accurate only to some number of decimal places. So if the tests are green and we push to production, some percentage of the time everything's okay, and some percentage it's not. So how much are we willing to invest to get better fidelity in the tests? And that's a continuum. And certainly different kinds of software require different levels of fidelity. And I think different personalities require different levels of fidelity. Another thing that I think we've been dancing around and haven't really addressed directly is overhead. So as we change some of these other levers, say if you want to increase the fidelity of the testing of your test suite, the cost of that's going to go up at the same time. So how much of that overhead are you willing to accept to get more frequent or higher fidelity feedback? And the last of the major issues that I identified is lifespan. How long is this software going to live? I'm often in the Facebook has this tradition of hackathons. And going into Facebook, I had a pretty fixed, here's how to program. And I realized that style with absolute confidence in the quality of the code, and so on, Well, of my hackathons, none have ever shipped. So I've participated in, I don't know, 10 or 12 hackathons. None of that code is still alive. So how much effort did I really need to put in to finding out that my idea wasn't worth pursuing? I had to write the code, but in this question of overhead, well, if I want to dial the overhead way up for code that's just going to be discarded because I wrote it to learn something, I learned it, and now I throw it away, it doesn't really make sense. So again, there's a continuum of lifespan, and lifespan isn't just measured in years, it's measured also in probabilities. This is really likely to live a long time. This is really likely to die very soon. So that's how I think about this trade-off. When somebody says, okay, well, what style of feedback do you want to get from tests? These are all the constraints. I think, well, okay, this isn't going to live for very long, but it's a really complicated algorithm, and so therefore I'm going to test about this much. And here's where I'm going to stop trying to think about crazy cases. And then I'm in some other situation, it's a load balancer, extremely high performance, and the curves go a completely different way. So I don't know if that helps to clarify the differences. I mean, we're not in this to agree. My personal goal is just to understand the set of trade-offs by having to articulate them to people who are prepared to tear my ideas apart in a constructive way. And I'm not aiming for agreement, but those are the things that I'm thinking about as I'm thinking about a style of testing. Does that jibe with what you guys consider different? Am I missing something?
Well, to some degree, but one thing that occurred to me as I was thinking about that closing question from last time is, well, there's more than one thing that you're looking for feedback on. One of the most important parts of feedback is this software doing something that's useful for the user of the software? And that's something that sometimes can be expressed very nicely through tests. The classic, here's the payroll, here are various example cases, work through the tests, works beautifully. On the other hand, I'm figuring out how I want to render my overview page of IsTDDead on into HTML, and I'm not actually quite sure what I want as an output until I try a few things and look to it. I want feedback, and I produce that feedback by looking at the page, seeing how it feels, clicking around. It's not something that's conducive to tests, which is a point that even Uncle Bob has made. If you're playing around with a user interface and you're trying to get that sense of what's it like going to be for my hopeful user, then that's not going to fit. So one category of feedback I would say is thinking about your users' needs and how you're going to satisfy them. And a second category is, have I broken anything? Now, I'm putting in this new little feature here. Have I broken something over there? And that's where the self-testing code notion, the regression suite, is such a lifesaver. To be able to run the tests and go, okay, I don't have to worry about stuff breaking elsewhere, is such a magnificent plus. That also ties into the whole issue of isolation and modularity and stuff. I'll put that to one side slightly, but that's another form of feedback you want. You want to know you haven't broken anything, and that's where, for me, the green bar, red bar is the real kick. I actually don't care about the green bar, red bar for the new functionality, because I want every test to fail, even if I'm doing TDD, before I see it succeed. But, or at least, I need to see it fail at least once, one way or the other. But that green bar, red bar is vital on the have I broken anything. And then the third dimension I see that is my code base healthy? Is this a code base I'm going to be able to continue to run quickly with for the length of time I expect to be working on it? And that's a much more tricky thing to get feedback on. And you build your aesthetic of how to name things, how to organize your code, but it's still a questionable thing, and it gets even more difficult if you know that code's going to be taken up by other people. Potentially even people you don't know yet. I mean, that's the classic problem that ThoughtWorks teams face. Right? They go in, they're doing a project, they don't even know who they're going to hand the code over to at some point. And so that really complicates the is the code base healthy aspect of the feedback. So that's three forms of feedback I can think of. User needs, have I broken anything, is the code base healthy?
And I think that that's part of the discussion that then goes a little broader than where a lot of the TDD discussion so far has centered on, which has been on these practices and on the sort of the style of the unit testing or whatever. And it's very much just talking about, oh, the programmer working on the code and what can he do for feedback. One of the things that we found or rediscovered, I guess, was before we had TDD and before we had programmers writing their own automated test suite, we had a lot of QA people, right? And then TDD actually, in many ways, became so successful that a large number of shops, they cut out their QA people. They don't have people doing QA anymore. Basecamp was one such shop for quite a long time. It's only 2 years ago, I think, that we started having somebody work QA, which by historic standards is an anomaly, right? Like most software otherwise produced would have a QA department. And I think part of the TDD being so successful in giving programmers confidence, it gave them overconfidence. I think it gave them overconfidence in the quality with which they can produce software through testing that they come up with as part of the development. And then they got so overconfident that they thought they didn't need QA, and then they started shipping software that not all parameters were better quality. I think they're obviously the old model was broken, right? Like just never testing your own code, throwing it to a QA department, you don't give a shit about the quality. It's just going to be a moral or royal mess for them because you know somebody else is going to clean up after you, right? So that's the pendulum swinging to one extreme. And then I think large extents we've swung too far back to the other extreme, which is, oh, well, I'm a programmer. I now have tools. I have TDD. I have all sorts of infrastructure that can make it so that I can test myself. I am sufficient. I can produce good software on my own accord. I don't think that's true at all. I don't think you can work on anything of material quality and produce great software without having somebody who's not you test it. And I think that it's disappointing to me that sort of have drifted out of the conversation. And the reason it's disappointing to me is I've seen just how powerful somebody who's not part of a real QA person can be, right? Somebody who walks in not knowing how I implemented things, somebody who's not thinking about my happy path, somebody who's just thinking about breaking my stuff before the users do. So I think that's one part of it. The other thing I wanted to focus on was to do this, the trade-off part, you have to know what the cost is. You have to know what the downside is. You have to know what the drawbacks are. And I feel like it hasn't actually been this when it's been TDD and testing. It's just been this. Like there's been one bar, which is the positive bar. This is, oh, let's make the test run faster. Minutes are better than hours. Well, great, let's do that. Well, seconds are better than minutes. Well, let's do that. Well, milliseconds are better than seconds. Let's do that. But you never got this back, right? Like, if you just keep chasing this and you just keep chasing improvement, I think you can become blind to what the original intention with trade-off was that you were trading something off of value. You're giving something away that was valuable that you didn't just want it to give away. It cost you something. It either cost you time, it cost you complexity, it cost you overhead, it cost you all these other things, right? And I think that discussion, where I'm seeing that's missing so distinctly is when I say stuff like test-induced damage, I see this look in some programmer's eyes just going, what the hell are you talking about? This is not even conceivable notion to me. I cannot even comprehend the fact that you could introduce damage through testing because I only see the one thing. I only see more tests or better tests, faster tests or better tests. Like, so we keep pursuing more and we keep pursuing faster as though that was the only sort of, it's only one part of the equation, right? So that's why I think we have to drag it back, and to get to this, we have to understand all those drawbacks. And I think that's where I think you're spot on when you say it's a continuum, because One other aspect, I mean, this is true in everything. So operations, for example, when we first launched Basecamp, I was kind of pleased when we got to 98.5% uptime. Like, that sounded impressive to me. Then at some point we got to 99%, and I'm like, hallelujah, this is amazing, right? And today we're at 5 nines. The cost of going from 99 to 5 nines was exponential, right? Which is the same thing, that's how I feel about tests. To get to, say, 99, 5 nines of coverage, it's going to be exponentially more expensive than to get to 99. And even getting to 99 is going to be so much more expensive than getting to 80. One of the terms that stuck in my mind when I read the first time was this notion of criticality, where if you're working on a NASA space launch module, you better chase 99.999, right? If you're working on pacemaker software, you better do that. If you're working on gluing some services together for a web app that's just launching, that's just exploratory, well, no. You should not do 5 nines of reliability. You should not do 5 nines of coverage. And I think that you can't have that conversation while at the same time having, at least from some quarters, the notion that you should not write a single piece of production line before you've written a failing test. Those things don't go together, right? You can't, on the one hand, claim, well, we need 100% coverage because that's our design methodology, and then at the same time also feel like, oh, well, we're doing a trade-off that depends on the criticality of our domain. So anyway, I think that that's where it's really interesting to talk about trade-offs. The interesting part is to talk about all the things that you're giving up and whether those things are worth giving up.
Yeah, I want to get back to what you were saying about QA, and now the pendulum has swung too far. And I think about it a little different. First, that old school. Now, I hate to play the age card, but I worked with QA departments enough times to see the dysfunctions that came about as a result of that. And the big one. The only piece of Facebook swag I have in my office is a big poster that says, nothing at Facebook is somebody else's problem. And the remarkable thing about Facebook as an engineering organization is the degree to which 7,000 people all actually agree on that. I've never seen an organization this big take this much responsibility. Getting rid of QA, and Facebook until very recently had no QA at all beyond programmers in the traditional sense. Now we have some people working on the mobile apps, but it's very programmers take responsibility, and it works okay. It's a question of compared to what. If you said, well, if you had a really healthy relationship, if as a programmer you still took responsibility, but somebody else was helping you be even higher quality, wouldn't that be better? Sure, if that's what you're going to compare it to, then absolutely. But the transition back in the dark ages wasn't from a healthy relationship; it was from this very dysfunctional, irresponsible attitude. Throw it over the wall. Long cycles. Vague feedback, going from that to programmers accepting responsibility for the quality of their work, that was a huge step forward. Can we go beyond that? Sure, absolutely. I don't even see it as a pendulum. There's some level of complexity in the platform you're on or the complexity of a product, you get over some threshold and a programmer can't keep all of the important possibilities in their head or doesn't yet know how to design in such a way that you can keep all those in your head. And then having external feedback about the functional quality of software certainly makes sense. But it's a continuum and it's a set of trade-offs, and I'm quite happy in most environments to accept the responsibility for that my code works and I don't need a net, and I work better if I don't have a net. So just in response to that one, Martin, did you have something to say about the rest of David's response?
Actually, I was also going to follow on from that. We can move on to the second one later. I mean, we at ThoughtWorks, pretty much all of our projects have some form of QA present. I mean, that's pretty much always been there right from the beginning, partly because, I mean, enterprises expect it, partly because of the sizes of our teams are often bigger. The shift that has really struck me from when I think of QA departments in the 90s, as well as this toss it over the wall, and the encouragement of this adversarial relationship where, you know, QA are there to catch the programmers out and poke sticks at them, and the programmer's reaction is, oh, who gives a toss, because it's, you know, if quality is your problem anyway. That has changed. It's much more collaborative. But the other shift as well is a hell of a lot of what QA people were doing was just mindlessly going through test scripts. And the automation has really got rid of that. And as a result, you can cycle much faster. You can say, oh, we can get this code, we can put it into a deployment pipeline, and we can get some answers in, you know, hours, and at the worst case, and we can then go and deploy from that. It's not a case of, well, the QA department's going to take a week to go through those changes. So that's, I think, from our perspective, the big shift. And the fact that it's also let a lot of startups be able to run for a while without any of that, I think is a huge liberating piece as well. So, I mean, that's how I see the kinds of the shifts in what's happened with QA.
And I think that's I think that's great, as long as that's the mindset that you have to it, that we're willfully trading off some degree of quality for the time being because we want to run fast, break things, and maybe we're not going to be around tomorrow. What I see is that people have internalized the notion of programmer testing to such a degree that they don't even recognize the value of exploratory testing or other than programmer testing. That's not everyone, but I feel like there's a generation of programmers who came up not knowing the battles of the 90s. The only thing they ever knew was programmers responsible for quality. They knew quality as meaning tests, automated tests, which is perhaps that was better, not even perhaps, that was better than what it came from, right? But it's also still a shallow understanding of what quality is. And I think it's part of those sort of blinders that you have on, that if you consider, well, I can create software that's completely of high enough quality just on my own without any out in QA, without any exploratory testing. I mean, my answer was simply, no, you can't. The only reason you think you can, and you know why you think you can? Because all your tests are fucking green, but they're not finding all the problems. All right? Like, as soon as you push out your code into the actual real world, users will start doing, why are they doing that? Why are they uploading this file or a folder or something else that they're not supposed to do? Like, nobody reasonable would upload a 2 gigabyte file into this field. Like, I didn't account for that. I didn't account for the fact that the moving on the back end will then take 50 seconds because I only tested with 5 megabyte files, right? There's this huge dark room that all of a sudden is switched on. Worst of all, though, is if when it's not switched on, which is what happens when customer service does not relay the atrocities that you've pushed out into the world, right? That's the kind of feedback that a lot of people are cutting off from themselves. Like, I've dealt with programmers for at least 10 years at Basecamp, where we've had this sort of inherent conflict that programmers didn't want to be on call. They didn't want to deal with customer complaints because that's kind of drudgery work. But it's also the information feedback loop, right? It's the feedback loop that goes beyond just, I wrote my own test, I'm designing my own feedback loop. Here's the actual real world flowing into that, right? And that's often ugly. People don't want to see that, right? I can understand in the same ways that TDDs, perhaps in the early days, taught people, like, here's this extra feedback loop, and people didn't like what they saw, right? Like, holy shit, my code actually is quite poor just when I'm testing it myself. So now you need or reach a level of proficiency where you can create code that you yourself can test and can be green, and that can feel good, but it can also be a plateau where you don't realize that there's many, many steps above that in quality and sort of the goodness of the program that come from actually users still find problems, right? Right. And that's sort of the split of like, oh, I have 100% coverage of my code, yet I still have bugs. Like there's some cognitive dissonance that's going on there where it's just like, how is this even possible? Like this is not supposed to be possible. All my tests are passing.
Right, and maybe we should always stipple a few red pixels in every green bar as a reminder not to be too arrogant about just what that means. And the on-call is the feedback loop that teaches you what tests you didn't write. Sometimes you can capture on-call things as tests. Sometimes you can capture them as alarms in or the need for more logging or the need for gathering more statistics. But it teaches you what feedback loops you don't have automated in place yet. And I'm with you on that. Facebook on call is programmers are on call, and it's not pleasant work, and everybody complains about it, and there's no way that we're going away from it because it's just so valuable as an engineer. I mean, as soon as you think that you're not making mistakes anymore, you're not willing to accept the possibility that you're making mistakes, then you're making a mistake. And you stop growing as an engineer. And that'll take you to some level of complexity, maybe, and then the world won't let you pretend that you're not screwing up anymore. So I'd rather catch that early. And if that means that I have a phone going off by my bed at 2 o'clock in the morning because, you know, some configuration of some load balancer got changed, and now my service is crashing, and there's a lesson for me to learn. If that's the price, that's the price I'll pay.
So talking about prices, we are now at our cutoff time. We didn't get to the second part much of David's point about costs. So is that something we should look at next time, look at the costs of a testing world?
Sure.
And I feel compelled to plug the fact that this guy, Mike Bland, who's an ex-Google guy, has been writing an article on my website and just published today, by coincidence, an installment on the costs and benefits of a testing culture. So maybe that could be a bit of input to it. If not, we can riff on how we go next week or whenever it's going to be.
Sounds good.
And again, we'll announce on the feeds when the next Hangout is. I've also got a regular page set up now that'll always have the next page and the links to all of the previous ones as well. So that should make things a little bit more organized.
Over time. We're programmers, after all.
Yeah, our next piece of organization will actually to be decide the next Hangout before we begin this one. That's my stretch goal for the future.
Sounds good.
Okay, so bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.